Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Paul Stern, professor of politics at Ursinus College. We're discussing his 2018 book, Dante's Philosophical Life, Politics and Human Wisdom in Purgatorio, from the University of Pennsylvania Press. Stern works on classical and early modern political philosophy and has written books on Plato's Phaedo, Socratic Rationalism and Political Philosophy, and on Plato's Theaetetus, Knowledge and Politics in Plato's Theaetetus. Let me say, first of all, Paul Stern, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Really happy to be here.
So, Paul, I love the book. It's a tremendous close reading of Dante's Purgatory. Although close reading, I think, doesn't even do it justice. I don't know what's closer than close reading. Very, very close reading. It's really illuminating.
Microscopic.
There we go. Yeah. So we'll talk about purgatory in general, I thought, and then we could talk about your overall argument, and then look at a few key passages in the text. Sure. But I thought maybe we could first start by maybe you could say a little bit about what motivated you to write the book, just what motivated you to write about Dante in general and then Purgatory in particular.
Sure. As I say in the book, I came to Dante quite late in my career. I encountered Dante thanks to a colleague that you as a graduate of Ursinus know well, John Volkmer in our English department, who insisted that Dante's Inferno be on the syllabus of our first year course, which is mandatory for all first year students and has a common syllabus taught in small sections by faculty from every department. And I just read it and was just captured, first of all, just by, even in translation, by the imaginative power of it, the imagery. It was just, you know, just fascinating to read. And I also sensed that there was a lot going on that I missed. And in particular, I was struck by how political it was. And I wondered about that. And so I read it for several years in that context. And then in 2008, Ursinus used to have a study abroad program that enabled a couple of faculty to join Ursinus students abroad, and in this case, in Florence. And so I had the pleasure of teaching Dante in Florence, and, you know, there's basically quotes from Dante in every corner. And just and at that point, I had recently finished a book on Plato's Theaetetus, and had thought about more Plato, and I thought, well, you know, why not take a chance and do something somewhat different? So I decided to immerse myself into Dante, taught it for several years, and was really guided and helped and assisted, as also I mentioned in the book, by two scholars who gave me some confidence that what I was seeing in Dante wasn't simply a projection. First of all, Ernest Fortin and his wonderful book, Descent and Philosophy in the Middle Ages, that makes the case for Dante's role in a rediscovery, a rehabilitation of political philosophy in the Middle Ages. And Teodolina Barolini in her book, The Undivine Comedy, whose title alone tells you where she's going. And both of them, you know, very courageous, because I guess like most areas of scholarship, there are orthodoxies, and seems to me, at least as an outsider, that's particularly true when it comes to Dante. But they bucked that orthodoxy sometimes successfully. But I was, as I say, given confidence that what I was seeing in Dante, that he was in fact treating politics in a philosophic manner, was there. And I decided to do something that's probably not widely done, which is focus on purgatory. And part of my argument is that the centrality of purgatory is not only literal but substantive, because it's only there that change is possible, and the whole realm of purgatory, as I argue, and as others have seen, really was developed in its details by Dante, and so he had a greater latitude in deciding what was going on in purgatory than he had in the other two realms. So I really looked at purgatory as the place in which he would most be able to develop his understanding of politics and ethics. So that's the reason for the focus on purgatorio, trying to, you know, have what I say be informed by the other canticles, but the, as you say, it's an attempt at a close reading of the central canticle.
Yeah, that's good. So maybe we could start with just talking briefly about purgatory in general. As you say, so purgatory, I was surprised to learn this, but so purgatory is basically Dante's invention, right? So there's no scriptural or theological basis for it. Is that right? Or
as he invented the whole realm, but it was, as I say, certainly not developed in the way that it became under, thanks to the comedy. And there's just a number of features that he adds to it. Chief among which, and the one that's really strange, is that it becomes a sort of school where people learn things and they develop and they change. So it's not simply sort of one of the previous images of it was almost, you know, commercial or economic, that for these sins done in this way, you serve X amount of time. Instead, you know, it becomes elaborated with all these different levels and all these different lessons learned and so on. And so the whole idea that, in fact, you could change in those significant ways after death was itself, as I understand it, was itself an innovation. So that's just one of the ways in which he makes of this realm something of great, great significance.
That's interesting. So the fact that he, it's so much of his innovation can really reveal his intent here by looking at it. So that, I found that interesting. It occurred to me in thinking about the what you were just saying about the architecture of the comedy. You draw a lot of parallels between Dante and Aristotle. And I wonder if there's something, you know, already here in the division, say, between the Inferno and Purgatory in, you know, Aristotle's own view about character, how some characters just can't be rehabilitated, right? Whereas, you know, Aristotle thinks that some can be, but some can't, right? And does Dante have similar kind of view that's reflected there? And, you know, the Inferno are those souls that are just lost, right? And the Purgatory Purgatory is reserved for those souls that can be rehabilitated through this process of purgation in ascending up this mountain that Dante himself is ascending. You see that Aristotle parallel?
Well, first of all, you know, just generally speaking, I mean, as many have seen, I mean, Aristotle, and in particular the Ethics, just, you know, suffuses the comedy. I mean, much of Dante's work, you know, and at one point in the Inferno, you know, Virgil stops in what he calls la tua ethica, you know, your ethics, and describes the architecture of Inferno along the lines of of the ethics. And what he describes there, and what I'm getting to is I think your question is really an interesting one that I have to think more about, but it's not always easy to say why exactly someone is consigned to Inferno instead of to Purgatorio. You know, sometimes it seems that, Dante, let me put it this way, Dante really makes you think sometimes about why this person is in purgatory rather than hell. I'm thinking in particular of the first ruler that he encounters in what's called Antipurgatory, which I'll talk about in a second, that whole realm, but Manfred. You know, so he's in purgatory, his father's in hell. And in some ways, his father, Manfred repents right at the end of his life. And he utters the syllable ma. And so one interpretation of that, you know, the interpretation given is, well, he was going to say Mary, and that's what redeems him. And, you know, the other thing he might have been saying is simply the Italian word, but. But his father, you know, earlier in his life and takes steps to remedy what he done. So anyway, the point is that it's not always clear what is it that gets you assigned to Inferno, that you really have to, Dante makes you tie it to his intention. And quite often it has to do with what Virgil outlines in Inferno, I think, which is the way in which you treated reason. What does your life say about the bearing of that distinctive human capacity for reason and for self-reflection? And that's what really gets you consigned to the depths of Inferno is, you know, it's not murder or something like that you might think, but it's things like fraud, that you not only neglected reason, but you used reason to sin. So, I think what seems maybe to make you redeemable is that there's still something about the way that you engage with reason.
Right. So is it right? Is the idea that this is something like, it's about your character, the evaluations about your character, not about like some score counting about your deeds or your sins. Like there's some basketball, scorecard up there in heaven that's counting what your sins and benefits. It's about, you know, how you order your soul, where the rational and appetitive, how the rational appetitive natures are in relation to one another.
No, that's exactly.
It's too.
Yeah, that's ahead. Exactly right. And one of the ways in which you can see Dante diverging from orthodoxy is that the moral outlook is very much oriented on virtue rather than sin. I mean, he uses, you know, the sin, the terraces are assigned in terms of sin. But, you know, when he seriously talks about ethics and morality, it has to do, as you suggest, much more with character, much more with a way of life, not, you know, this particular deed, but how you comported yourself, and especially to return to this idea, how your life was, to the extent to which your life was informed by reason, is what he's very much concerned with, rather than through that particular offense.
Yeah, so this, I mean, it raises the question, I think, the structure, the organization of purgatory, just sticking, I guess, with this sort of introduction about purgatory in general. I mean, you said briefly about the organization of Inferno, which makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, Inferno is the text that I know, probably most people know. We sort of stop reading after the juicy bits in Inferno. But the purgatory has, it sort of goes back over the same sins, but in a different order. Is there some sort of quick way to sort of grasp the structure, like why Dante puts the sins in that in the particular order and the terraces in its ascent?
Yeah, I mean, my argument is, and I think before I lay out my argument, I think that it's the order is key to his intention, and that, you know, any adequate interpretation will, as in books that are written in this way, you know, think about that movement, because, you know, the book is also I claim is dialectical in the sense that it wants you to have an experience. And, you know, there's a progress in it. Obviously, the image of Dante's progress brings that home, his helical ascent. But there's a movement and a progress in it that I think is necessary for an interpreter to get a hold of. And my particular take on this is that the first three sins concern, and by the way, Virgil again lays this out, or at least laying it out is probably to say too much, but he indicates this at a certain point in Purgatory. But the first three sins concern sins done to one another, and then I understand the Terrace of Sloth, which is the fourth terrace, as a pivot on which Dante pivots to sins that concern one's life as an individual. Are you pursuing the good? So that's the organization as I understand it. And he encounters the first sin he encounters is pride, which is, you know, the first sin in the tradition as well, but it's also the sin that he has to deal with, because the project that I'm attributed to him, and I'm not alone in this, you know, as epic poems do, a rethinking of how best to live and an attempt to, you know, persuade others to live in this new way through a rethinking of political life, obviously a prideful undertaking. And not only that, but this rehabilitation of serious politics will be a politics in which pride isn't simply rejected as a sin. So I also understand what he's doing is that as he goes through each sin, he's reinterpreting them to accord with this this politics that's reminiscent of classical politics. I'm not arguing that he's trying to simply rehabilitate the polis. What I am arguing, though, is that he's trying to make a space for that view in his world. So that requires him to deal with pride, first of all. And then part of that dealing with pride is Dante celebrating great achievement, including, as he invariably does, his own. And he's the hero of this book, and he's not shy. In fact, the opposite, about, you know, making a claim for his own achievement, you know, in the course of the achievement, that is to say, even before, obviously, it's become, you know, this great book, classic text, world historical text. So, and that's also one of the things that's I find so attractive about him. Yeah. But in pointing out, you know, that great range of human possibility, from the worm to the butterfly, as I'm paraphrasing, as he puts it at one point, he has to deal next with an issue of justice. And that's what he does on the Terrace of Envy. Is there a good that comprehends the great variety of human undertakings? Is there in fact a common good that we can refer to? And that's what he's dealing with on the terrace of envy? How does it stand as between the variety of individual goods on the one hand, intrinsically shareable goods on the other? And in the course of that, he encounters, one of the people encounters, Guido della Duca, who asks this question that just continues to haunt him, which, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but the question is something like, you know, how can it be that so few people actually pursue the genuine good? So that, you know, spurs in Dante wonder about what we are such that we can pursue such diverse goods, and such that the ultimate good, the supreme good, happiness, is so rarely achieved and seems available to so few. And the third terrace, the terrace of wrath, and it's on this terrace for reasons we could talk about, but in the terrace of wrath, he encounters another figure who is regarded as, and I think this is right, as very much reflective of Dante himself, Marco Lombard, who articulates a vision of the whole that accounts for how can it be that human beings can be so different from one another, so diverse? How can it be that we can err? You know, the whole comedy gets going because Dante realizes that he's gone astray. And it really is difficult to explain what does it mean that someone can go astray? How can you be less than what you are? Again, how can we err? How can we lie? And how can we strive and aspire and love? So that's what he has his Marco do, is articulate the view of the whole that accounts for that. Now, so at that point, what I argue is that we've seen Dante's view of the truth of the whole, of how it's put together so as to allow the possibility that humans are the erring, artful, striving, erotic beings that we are. But at that point, the problem that arises is, how do you live with that truth? Because that truth undermines some of our greatest, you know, most immediate, most urgent hopes, you know, namely that we can know how everything is, that we can achieve perfect happiness, self-sufficiency, that we can answer to all our desires. And is the Terrace of Sloth is where he confronts the existential fact of that truth and how difficult it is to live with it. And that he does in his central dream. He dreams three times in Purgatorio, and the one in Terrace of Sloth is the central one, where he encounters a woman that he regards as, it's called a siren, and she's regarded as extraordinarily beautiful and the answer to all his desires, at which point an unnamed woman, I think it's Beatrice, shows up with Virgil, and she makes Virgil rip off the clothes of the siren and reveal it as a objectionable hag. And the last three terraces, Dante deals with those obstacles derived from our passions, those obstacles that make it so hard to deal with the genuine good, to deal with the fact that desire, lack, neediness are permanent features of our life, that completeness always eludes us, and to see that not simply as an evil, but in fact, perhaps the ground of all those things that we actually regard as good. And that's the ascent to earthly paradise. Is, you know, Dante, having seen how that can be the case and living that life in earthly paradise, where there's not completeness, but there is striving, eros, further thought, enigmas, riddles, perplexities, but all those now seen as aspects of a fulfilling life. And he has this phrase that I quote several times, but he says that there he tastes that food, which by satisfying makes one thirst for it. So the last three terraces, I understand as articulating what I call the desirability of desire. And that coincides too with the principle of his poetry that he expresses on the Terrace of Gluttony, which is in this one of the last three terraces, in which he says what he looks up to, what he loves, is love. He reveres love. So that's to live with the truth understood in that way is the challenge of the last the last three terraces.
Yeah, that's great. I just hate to do this, but to back up just a little bit, but I mean, just to put your main argument in context here, because that was a really nice sketch, sort of the overall claims of the book. So my general understanding before I read your book was, I guess, the sort of received understanding of, well, I guess purgatory, but also Divine Comedy in general, which is, you know, Dante's up to a kind of religious project in it. It's a kind of, I don't know, even at a kind of like extension of the Bible, right? That it's sort of fleshing out your theological concerns. So he's in that way much closer to Aquinas than, say, Aristotle. But so your argument in the book, and again, as you said, it's you're not the first to do this, but you certainly build on it, is that it's a very heterodox project. It's a project that's engaged in not a religious aim, but a philosophical aim, that is the justification not of a religious life as the highest form of life, but a philosophical life as the highest form of life. So maybe you could just start, I guess, just what led you and what maybe should lead some readers to question Dante's religious aim or religious orthodoxy or this sort of religious angle to his poetry.
Sure. Just by the way, you persist in your original understanding?
No. Certainly not. No, I was completely transformed. So that's good.
My work here is done.
So, I haven't read Paradiso though, so I guess it remains still.
Well, you don't need to.
You know, an open question. Maybe he turns it all around in Paradiso. I don't know.
Well, part of my at least assertion,
you needed a sequel to your book.
Yeah. Well, my assertion is, and I think I could justify it in it, or else I wouldn't have asserted it. But that ultimately Paradiso does point back to Purgatorio. But and I'll come back to that. But the dean of American Dante scholarship, a man named Charles Singleton, I quote him and he puts it this way, says, Dante sees as poet and realizes as poet what is already conceptually elaborated and established in Christian doctrine. So unquote. So I think that's, that's succinctly unconclusively stated that Dante is in a way, and this is maybe a little extreme, but Dante is Aquinas set to verse, something along those lines. And I would say that that's still the dominant view, maybe not that extreme, but still the prevailing view. I presented my work at an actual Dante conference, and I'm here to confirm that that's the prevailing view. One of the people in the audience came up to me afterwards and said, "Why do you want to take away our hope?" I don't at all mean to make light of that, because I actually found it quite refreshing. Dante matters still. And that's testimony to the people for whom it matters and to Dante himself. But this idea that there's something else going on here, and this really is one of the things that I was led to by Professor Barolini's work, this idea that there's something fishy going on here, was evident in the reception, the immediate reception to Dante. His son wrote numerous commentaries, as one scholar puts it, to explain away the problems that many people saw. And you know, the comedy itself was, Dominicans forbade reading of it. Fortin has this argument that the church ultimately dealt with it by embracing it, dealt with its heterodox aspects by embracing it and saying, yes, this is great. This is what we believe. And in a way undermined how heterodox it was. So the point here, first point is that contemporaries saw this, you know, people who had a stake in it, saw how problematic it was. And Barolini, you know, I think really nicely points that out, and that it's in a way really a misreading, a domestication of Dante, to read him along the lines, simply along the lines that Singleton does. Now, I would also say that orthodoxy, thanks to people like Berlini and others, you know, that orthodoxy is not quite what it once was. There's work, especially, you know, seeing how just erotic a text it is, that you know, in the last 10, 20 years, a number of scholars have seen that have helped break through some of those givens. But still, I think one of the issues is in doing that is, and here's what I was helped to see by Fortin, is, okay, so is he saying, you know, not faith, reason, in a sort of binary way? And that argument had been made earlier, you know, much earlier. And I think that in a way also is to sell Dante short and not see the real grandeur and complexity of his project. It's not to simply say not this, but that. Because that's, as I also argue, that's simply to replace one orthodoxy with another. And that's not what he's doing. He's not replacing faith with what would be rationalism. And that's the way in which I think he outdoes and exceeds and sees more deeply than, you know, where sometimes, you know, the Latin Aristotelians, Seeger and other people like that. I think Dante sees more deeply into Aristotle, sees something that Aristotle saw, that this philosophic way of life, insofar as it does not make available a comprehensive rational account of all things, it needs to be defended. It needs to be argued for. It's not self-evident that living that life isn't therefore arbitrary, isn't therefore the most self-forgetting insofar as it doesn't provide a rational ground for its own existence. And I think Dante sees that. And that's what moves him to think about politics more deeply, and to see, as I also argue, that the key inquiry is ethics, not metaphysics. And here he learned, I believe, from a number of thinkers with whom he was quite familiar, and especially a thinker like Al-Farabi and Maimonides. Al-Farabi saw this too in seeing, you know, that the metaphysics is ultimately an aporetic work. And what does one do then, in the face of those aporias that Aristotle leaves at the end of the metaphysics? And here helpful was Josh Perrins' work on Al-Farabi was really helpful in that. So Dante knew those thinkers. He knew, he certainly knew Averroes and you know, in Limbo, talks about in a certain place in Purgatorio. So he knew that issue. And my argument is that he wasn't simply, you know, opposing rationalism to faith, that he was making an argument for the good of a different way of life, a life of rational inquiry, as an alternative to the life of faith. Now that also requires him to take with utmost seriously the life of faith and not simply reject it. And that he does too. So in saying that he's heterodox, I don't at all mean to say that he's simply rejecting Christianity. I think that he, in the culture that he's trying to bring about, again, not simply rehabilitating classical world, which he, as a good Aristotelian, knows is not possible, but rather making the argument that the healthiest culture would have these alternatives be actual alternatives, live alternatives, which requires that Christianity be healthy. And my understanding is, and my argument is that he thinks that the association of Christianity and politics did great damage to Christianity itself, and wants to free it from that entanglement to the extent possible. You know, he wants to, I mean, if you think about the end of the Euthyphro and Socrates' argument, the Euthyphro that drives a wedge between justice and piety, I think that's one of the things he's trying to do Dante's trying to do with regards to Christianity. It would be much healthier both for society and for Christianity were it to focus more on those theoretical issues that it makes salient about, you know, the status of the body with respect to the soul, what it means for our lives that we have the perspective of eternity, all the issues related to thinking through the immortality of the soul, that those issues both enrich Christianity and would enrich a culture in which rational inquiry is also an element, because posing it a constant challenge to that life of rational inquiry that makes it aware of the need to defend itself.
Okay. Yeah. So I had this question of clarification right up until the end. I think you sort of answered it, which is, how actually does Dante stand towards Christianity? I mean, so he's not anti-Christian, but what, you know, is there some kind of positive benefit to Christianity, or is it just some sort of instrument for, you know, preserving and promoting the philosophical life as a kind of exoteric doctrine and set of institutions that preserve it? Your last comment was suggestive, I think, and you also say in the book something about, you know, that, you know, Christianity, unlike the ancient rationalists, sort of gave it insight into, or, you know, paved the pointed towards the depths of the soul that the ancients weren't sort of privy to or didn't develop. I mean, I guess one of the things I want to point to in asking you, and feel free to answer this now, but the is there any way in which Dante is different than Aristotle, right? I mean, does he develop a view of philosophy beyond this sort of zetetic, you know, constantly seeking, questioning view of philosophy that's opposed to the sort of Neoplatonic, metaphysical, Augustine, Aquinas type conception? You know, does he sort of incorporate Christianity in a distinctive way, or is it kind of like exoteric shell with an Aristotelian core? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's a great question that I thought about, and I'm not sure how successfully or how much progress I've made, but let me say a few things. I don't think Dante is simply averroistic in his treatment of religion, and by that I mean it's you know, it's simply exoteric, that it's trying to think of a way to say this without crude or mischaracterized, that it's somehow simply for the rubes, and you know, then the philosophers go off and you know, do their thing and do you know, are the only fulfilled people and that sort of thing. And I've seen that treatment of Dante, and I think that's also a misreading, just in terms of pedagogically speaking, which is to say, I've seen a treatment of Dante that, well, there's a surface teaching, that's Christianity, and you know, has rings fairly or in an orthodox way. And then there's the real Dante, and that's completely divergent from that. And I don't think that doesn't make sense to me simply from a pedagogical standpoint, which I think is very much central to Dante's purpose. And what I mean by that is this. I think Dante sees the need for an ascent from the way in which the dominant ways in which his culture thinks to a deepening of them, ascent that takes you through those ways of thinking, doesn't leave them completely behind. It isn't somehow you know, completely divergent, because then I don't understand how one gets from there to from one point to the next. and that doesn't square with his notion of esoteric writing, which he has this very much a notion of. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing is, and here, you know, you know Nietzsche, you know, better than I, but you know, I had in mind, and maybe you did too, you know, Nietzsche's argument about the deepening of the soul brought about by Christianity. Did you have something like that in mind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so, mind, yeah. And on the one hand, I don't want to say that Plato and Aristotle weren't aware of the depth of the soul. But on the other hand, I do think there's a consideration of the interiority of the soul, or human interiority, that Dante found in Christianity, found it provocative, found it true, and thought was absolutely worth preserving. And one of the best ways to preserve it was through reflection on Christianity. And in that way, then, among other ways, you know, Christianity isn't simply a cloak or somehow, you know, the exoteric face that some can dispense with. Not only because to do that is, again, I think, to lapse into rationalism. So the issue of, you know, is Dante in any way different from Aristotle? I think that just having to deal with Christianity in a way that obviously Aristotle didn't makes him different. having to deal with the pervasive presence of the notion of eternity, I think gives a different flavor to what he's up to. I think also I found his reflections on form, on poetry. Now, I'm not a student of the poetics, but I found, Dante's use of and reflection on poetry inform my understanding in a way that I hadn't conceived of prior to dealing with Dante, which enabled me to understand better, I think, than I did Plato's use of poetry and Plato's account of poetry. So, I would say, I'm not going to say Dante's somewhat different, but I think there's a different focus and he elaborates on some issues in ways that I found helpful. But I think ultimately he is still has that understanding of philosophy as a way of life devoted to deepening reflection on human good.
Yeah, I think about the comparable text in the ancient world, like Plato's Republic or Aristotle's Ethics, comparable in the sense they're both dealing with, an account of the soul and the soul's education or development.
Right.
And, what's distinct is Dante is giving you a vivid, I guess they use the same word again, interior picture of, this development. So he'll, stumble across people in the Inferno and they'll tell their stories. And it has this sort of personal character to it, very contrast to, say like Plato's Republic, where it's very much of a kind of abstract character to the count, or even Aristotle's Ethics, where it's overly rationalistic. I mean, I don't want to minimize the poetic elements. Of course, you have Plato, as you mentioned, but yeah, I mean, there's certainly this, at each step along the way, Dante isn't just sort of finding the mean between different extremes. He's, assessing the particulars and context-ridden character of each of these individuals and their sins and their virtues, right?
Yeah, I'm going to first push back violently against abstract with regard to Plato, but apart from that, I have to recover myself here. But after that, I think you're exactly right that I'm not sure I want to claim a difference in kind, but I think Dante, you see someone take full advantage of that, the poetic, philosophic use of poetry, and understand that this again is my argument that this use of poetry, and more specifically, this proceeding by one encounter after the other with characters, with individual figures who have a history, who have, are in some regards very, very idiosyncratic, unforgettable in many ways. There's that Dante does it, and also invites you to reflect on the philosophic import of that. Why proceed in this way? And I think it very much has to do with the idea that this is precisely not abstract. That ultimately this is a way of life, but and as such, it's a way of life that has to be um, uh, uh, chosen by each one separately, because it requires the overcoming of various passions. And that can't be done by one person for another. And that's also part of my argument why, you know, there isn't, when you get to the near the end, there isn't this moment when, you know, Dante sort of said, okay, here's the argument why, you know, you should pursue philosophy. You come up to that point, but ultimately what it's made clear that this is something that for Dante too has to be chosen. He's the one that has to choose to go through the fire. And, you know, quite literally does, you know, at the end of the terrace of lust. I think in that sense, and that's what I meant when I was getting at the idea that thinking about Dante helped me understand better Plato's decision to present philosophy in and through, you know, the account of Socrates. This is, by the way, an issue that comes up in regards to the comedy, which is why, what happened such that Dante decided to present a wholly poetic view? Because prior to that, Dante had presented in what's called prosymmetrical, which is that he would present poetry and then helpfully interpret the poetry for it. And talk about, you know, he doesn't want to get it wrong. He doesn't want to make sure that, you know, when you read it, you get it right when you want when I'm having it. But then with the comedy, he presents wholly poetic presentation. And I think it's for the reasons, I think it is a good question to ask. A guy named John Scott raises it, but it's a good question to ask. And I think that's the rationale, for it, that he does see that philosophically speaking, it's most appropriate, to present himself in terms of individual reflections on individual ways of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I guess pursue this a little bit more, which is to think about the relationship between poetry and philosophy in Dante, in contrast to Plato. So again, I guess the question is, how's Dante different than Plato? I asked a second ago how he might be different than Aristotle, but just to maybe like suggest a few things and see what you think of this. Yeah. I mean, first of all, so Dante is the character in his own poem, right? Which is a marked contrast to Plato, who doesn't appear anywhere. I mean, this is a great challenge of Plato's scholarship, as you well know. This is as a scholar of Plato, that's, you know, what actually is Plato saying? He never actually says anything, right? Because he's absent. He just organizes these characters and makes them say things. So Plato is sort of self-effacing in the way Dante is emphatically not. And Dante sort of is the character that goes through this kind of development. I mean, I guess the other thing that occurred to me is, and I don't know, what do you think about this sort of, I guess you might say, the kind of prophetic character to Dante's or project, or his, you know, the way in which you might think of him as a kind of founder in like Machiavelli sense. I mean, he's seen, you know, in your telling of Dante, you know, he has this ambition as a kind of founder to reorganize, say, the church and politics in such a way as to make sure the philosophical life continues. You know, so he has, I don't know what you think of this. I mean, there's more of an ambition with regard to politics than Plato. I don't know. I mean, you've now worked for most of your life on these two figures. So do you see differences, or you see them as Dante sort of following in Plato's footsteps?
Yeah, well, let me do the first question first about, you know, the Dante, as you indicate, Dante is he's the hero of the story, and I mean, on the one hand, you can argue that, you know, Plato is you know, obviously, as you say, never speaks in his own voice, and so, you know, is behind the scenes in a way, in opposition to Dante. But I guess I would also suggest that Dante, by making himself the hero, how shall I put this? In a way, is perhaps even more the background than Plato would be, because one might say, "Oh well, you know, Dante's the hero, and this is what Dante says." And I think that, you know, that would be a misreading. It's a misreading that I think, you know, Dante may have you know, invited. But I think in a way it makes it even more difficult to say what is Dante saying when he himself makes the hero. So what you have with Dante is you have this character called Dante, who, as I just said, makes himself the hero, who has all these, you know, experiences and events and conversations. But then also there's Dante as the poet within the poem, right? So, you know, Dante has had this entire experience, and now he's also this character who's sitting at his desk thinking about, you know, having, you know, gone through hell and purgatory and paradise and reflecting on it. But then there's at least the third, and one could say the fourth and fifth, but let's just talk about the third. But then the third is, you know, the actual person Dante, who's the, you know, the world historical figure that actually wrote the poem. So in that regard, I think that in a way, as difficult as getting at, you know, the Platonic author, Plato as author, I think as surely as difficult, and I would say perhaps even more, is getting at, you know, Dante the author. In other words, more screens even than Plato. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's fair enough. Point taken. Although, I mean, the difference still remains, right? That on the one hand, you have Socrates or the Eleatic Stranger or whatever versus Dante. You know, the fact that he does, I mean, I guess you just put it in the form of a question, which is, why does Dante make Dante the hero rather than like every man or, you know, some other kind of figure?
Yeah. Okay. I see. And my argument for that is that, you know, there are other heroes of epic poems, right? I mean, there's, you know, Achilles, Aeneas, each one of which, you know, highlights a certain human quality. That certain human quality also entails a certain view of the whole. Dante, insofar as he's, you know, rehabilitating epic poetry, does that. Then the question is, okay, why is, what does Dante's hero Dante mean? And my sense is that it's precisely because he wants to highlight the quality of self-reflection that he himself has to be the hero. That the comedy, the poem, is the drama of self-reflection. What does it mean to live a life such that we can think about the kind of life that we live. And that's the reason, it seems to me, that he has to be the hero of his own epic poem.
Yeah. And this again, I mean, I think, you know, redounds to the interiority point from before. I mean, if the whole comedy is, you know, can be understood as a kind of drama of self-reflection or drama of, you know, self-development or something like that. I mean, it strikes me as very modern in that sense, right? It could, you know, it could be a really long, like, psychoanalytic study, right? The kind of, you know, the self-development of the soul. So, I mean, in this way, it again is very much like Nietzsche, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's well put. In terms of the idea of the prophet founder, I would agree with that too. I think that, while I don't want to argue that let me back up. So when Dante talks near the end of Marco Lombard's speech on the Terrace of Wrath, he states that the guide is what he calls the tower of the truth city. And one might say, well, this is, in a sense, a notion of natural law. There are these principles on the basis of which one could deduce the human good and apply them. That I don't think is Dante's view. So I would back off of seeing him as you know, instituting simply some practical project based on his metaphysical understanding of things. I think rather that his practical undertaking, when he talks about the tower of the true city, this would take some time, but read the book. when he talks about the tower of the true city, I think that it's very much like his understanding of truth in Purgatorio, which the way he puts it is non-false error, which I think is wonderful. But thinking about that in terms of his political project means that he wants to think about justice both in what's possible and what its limitations are. So the tower is the best, but also the best that's available and possible, given how we understand human nature. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, prudence, you know, one of the epigraphs is this statement in Paradiso about prudence, that prudence becomes the chief cognitive capacity. But having said that, I do think he means to alter, modify his culture, that he has the sense that the current culture, I can use that word for shorthand, is defective, that it's both from the standpoint of Christianity and from the standpoint of the general understanding of philosophy, are oriented on certitude rather than truth. And what he means to do is to establish, develop a more generative culture. That is to say, a culture which comprises serious alternatives in tension with one another. And again, to go back to something we discussed, a culture in which classical politics is alive, a culture in which Christianity at its best is alive, a culture in which those contend with one another. You know, in the Terrace of Pride, there's this wonderful activity where he sees three different reliefs, and he moves from one to the other, and the first one, always with the images that he sees, the one that always has to do with Christianity, with Mary, but then the second one moves to a hero of his, to David, and his you know, the event where he's dancing in front of the in the Bible where David dances and he lifts up his garments and basically exposes himself, and his then wife is disgusted. But Dante, you know, loves David. He's the figure from the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament that he most mentions, because he's both a founder, a poet, and highly erotic. And then the third relief that he talks about is Trajan, is you know, the Roman emperor. So my point is it's not that somehow you know, the classics had it right, or Christianity had it right, or you know, the Hebrew Bible has it right. What he means to articulate is a culture in which all three are present, and all three are in tension with one another, and each one has to answer to the other. Whether he was successful developing such a culture, I don't know, or that's another question. But I do think that is his intention, and that's part of what fascinates me about Plato, about Aristotle, about Dante, and about Herodotus, which is how do you argue for openness? How do you argue for the persistence of inquiry? And that is really, I think, A, something that is of great importance for us right now, and B, something that's really difficult to think about theoretically. You know, how does one, without lapsing into, you know, utter openness on the one hand, or, you know, a different kind of, you know, certitude, orthodoxy on the other. And I think Dante intends to do this. And one of the things that I found so attractive about him is the depth in which he thought about the premises of inquiry and of openness.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the political view here of Dante. We're almost an hour and 10 minutes of the conversation on a political theory podcast. We haven't talked about politics. So there you have it. So, but politics is central, is very crucial to your book. It's very crucial to the teaching of the purgatory, on your view. It's crucial to even the argument to defend the good life of philosophy. And it, as I understand it, it's connected to what you were just saying, which is that there's a kind of contradictory character to human life, that we have these competing goods and aims. You know, there's kind of, you know, aim for worldly goods, there's aims for heavenly aim, or contemplation, and so forth. And sometimes these things can't be rationally compared. And it's just sort of politics in order to, you know, make possible the coexistence of these two things. And so maybe I'll ask you to just sort of continue and elaborate on what you were just saying, because part of it is I was a little bit confused as to how, you know, or I guess what this politics would look like. Because on the one hand, so one way one could go is a kind of liberalism, right? Which, you know, makes possible various different kinds of lives, the coexistence of various different kinds of lives. Although one worry on that front is a kind of arguably what we may be seeing today, which is a kind of, you know, a flat relativism, a way in which the, you know, the question of the good life becomes a non-issue in its becoming privatized. But on the other hand, it seems like part of the problem with politics is that, you know, there's constantly you know, people who want to seek power, and they want to seek to impose their own preferred goods on others. So I guess maybe one question is sort of, how does Dante envision his politics such that the coexistence of these different kinds of conflicting goods can be maintained, of course not harmonized, but maintained in their tension? Or it reminds me a little bit of, like, you know, John Stuart Mill and the, you know, his freewheeling discussion among conflicting views and keep those conflicting views alive. What do you think?
Yeah. And this is part of what I was trying to get at, what I was just talking about. So let me start from the issue that connects to my concerns about liberal education. Let me start that way, and you can stop me at any point.
It's okay. Go ahead.
I'll just hang up and I'll go leave. it seems to me that, you know, there's two kinds of two orthodoxies that are characterize, you know, our current understanding of things. And what I want to argue is that Dante helps us avoid both of these orthodoxies. One of them is the view that the notion of human good, the question of what is the true good, that's a question that we need not explore. We need not, because we know the answer. Modern science has told us, and here I would appeal to Francis Bacon, who I teach regularly now, that we all know that what's good is a life that's long, pleasurable. That's what everyone desires, and so we need not ask those questions that Dante wants us to ask. One of the dominant currents in intellectual life in our time is modern science, and the other one is the humanities, would suggest not that those questions need not be asked because we know the answer, but rather there's no answer to them. They're impossible to respond. We can't, there's no way of discerning that one way of life is preferable to any other. So, which I think is also a kind of certitude and a kind of orthodoxy. The way I understand Dante in this way, and this is the way also I understand the argument for liberal education more generally, is the argument that, you know, both of those views are inadequate. And Dante is trying to make an argument that, in fact, we do need to still think about how best to live a life of faith, a life of reason, and B, it's wrong to think that we can't at least make some progress in discerning which way of life is better than another way of life. So politically speaking, as I was trying to indicate before, I think that his notion of healthy politics is a politics in which those alternatives are both taken seriously. So if you want to put it in terms of liberalism, it would be a politics in which the way one would put it perhaps is that equality and freedom are taken both taken seriously, and the tension between them. And at one point, you know, I say that a politics, a culture, political community, in which Christianity were alive and taken seriously, in which rational inquiry were alive and taken seriously, would be one in which the argument for what humans share generally on the one hand and the human excellence on the other were constantly in tension with one another and in dialogue with one another. So that's, and I think that can be expressed in a number of different ways in a political community. And I think it can be expressed in the context of liberalism without lapsing into either, you know, relying on simply ideology that we know what's good and we need not ask what is good anymore, nor judging that you know that no one can actually know better what is a better way of life. So it's the attempt to articulate a politics that attempts to articulate and preserve that tension is what Dante is attempting to do, and I think you know, with what success is a question that's hard to discern, but I do think still can serve as a model of how of a healthy politics.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think it seems like one of the themes that runs through, your book, but also Dante, is ways in which is a concentration of power or too much power can actually corrupt the soul or corrupt the possibility of leading a happy life, right? So one of Dante's main projects is to, as you said earlier, chasten the temporal ambitions of the church. He talks about this in De Monarchia, right? But it's also throughout the comedy. And so, I mean, it seems like part of his aim is to be engaged in something like what Socrates does, is to engage in a project of self-critique and to encourage others to be engaged in a project of self-critique, in part because the power tends to blind one to the, you know, sort of unsupported assumptions that we make, and that you know, constant inquiry can actually be intrinsically rewarding. And so a regime that doesn't actually, you know, concentrate power in any one particular alternative can actually be the one that generates the most happiness.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that that's part of the problem that he sees with that the extent to which, you know, Christianity has become political, and he really wants to not somehow diminish, eradicate Christianity, but drive a wedge between piety and justice, as I said before, have it be one element of a number of serious alternatives that are part of this this diverse culture, diverse in the most interesting and important way that Dante is trying to articulate. And again, I think without, you know, making the argument that, you know, one can simply apply Dante to, you know, the year 2018, I do think that it's worth considering Dante for those who want to think more deeply about just what we should mean by diversity, and B, what are the genuine satisfactions that are available in that kind of diversity. I also want to say that Dante is fully aware that those issues those alternatives that can in fact exist within a community that they're not resolvable on the political plane. That is to say, they point towards a kind of life that transcends politics. Every political community, including one in which these alternatives are live, at some point is going to have to limit that kind of inquiry, precisely because every political community has not only to reflect on the meaning of nobility or beauty on the one hand, but more urgent desires. So this is not at all to suggest that the political plane on its own is sufficient, but rather that there are certain kinds of politics that are healthier in themselves, but also are more conducive to pointing to that rational way of life that goes beyond politics.
Yeah, the speech by Marco Lombard in the 16th canto seems to summarize a fair bit about what we've been talking about. I mean, so this is the speech right in the center of the entire Divine Comedy, right? So it has an extremely important position, and it's a discussion that has a kind of like sort of metaphysical bearing, but also a very political bearing. It's a question about free will and responsibility, and Dante is in this, is concerned about this question, and Marco Lombard gives this kind of sort of political discussion about his. About Lombardy and how his kingdom has fallen apart. And part of the problem, at least I take it from your discussion and from the comedy, is that there's a problem of political power and doesn't recognize the plurality of different incommensurable goods that can be preserved under law, right? So Marco Lombard points to the importance of law as a way to sort of reconcile these different goods. I'm certainly not capturing that speech that well, but it seems to me it brings together a lot of these strands.
Yeah, I think so, and it is just really striking that as you just pointed out. I mean, the how that speech, where it's situated in the Commedia as a whole, and also that it's this extraordinarily important speech is given by a political type of person, a person of prudence, who, as I indicated previously, as several people point out, reflects Dante himself in many ways. But so you have this person of prudence articulate a view of the whole, but it's a view of the whole that indicates what the whole must be, such that prudence is both possible and necessary, which is to say that there are differences among humans, differences that reflect different notions of good that are incommensurable, are not wholly reducible to one good. What must the whole be such that that's true? So in a way it's to say that the view of the whole that's indicated there is meant to turn us from you know, metaphysics, some, you know, there's some ultimate principle on the basis of which all of these different views of goods can be reconciled. It's to turn us back to further reflection on what we are and what the whole must be, such that prudence is the chief cognitive capacity, not appeal to something akin to natural law, something akin to, principles from which how we ought to live is simply deduced. So, Marco's speech. And the other thing really interesting about Marco's speech is that it's of extraordinary importance, but once that vision of the whole is conveyed, which, as I pointed out earlier, is Dante, I think, thinks is the truth of things, that's not the end of the story. Because then the story becomes, how can someone, each of us on his or her own, how do we live with that? How do we overcome those passions, which Marco hasn't quite done, and Dante needs to do? How do we overcome those passions, which makes us say, wow, that's a hard truth to live with. I think I'll go back to natural law, if you don't mind. Because Dante sort of offhandedly, he raises this sort of bit of gossip about someone that that Marco Lombard knows. And then Dante sort of points to the fact, well, he has this, you know, he's a great guy, but he has this daughter who's somehow not so admirable. And Marco says, sort of, okay, I'm done. If you're going to talk about that, then I'm out of here.
Right.
and it reflects this thing that Dante, this thing that gets said in Anti-Purgatory, which is, I think, to me of the utmost importance, which is probity doesn't necessarily, you know, rise up through the branches. And again, I'm paraphrasing, but what he means to convey is that there are, we are, the human whole is elusive, such that we don't really understand why one person is noble or excellent, and his or her offspring is either an idiot or a tyrant or so on. Our nature is elusive. It's not simply a matter of, you know, genetics, of inheritance. It's both, to understand the human is both genetic, but also eidetic. And, you know, when he finally gets around to giving an account of the human whole, it's by this character who doesn't invent. There is Astatius, another epic poet, but all the details are invented, and it's this figure called Statius who Dante has articulate, you know, the character of the human whole, a character who he himself is a hybrid. He is both, writes epic poetry on the one hand, but is also, you know, and Dante just makes this up, is a secret Christian. So again, expressing that kind of hybrid that he hopes this political community can also express. Not that this difference is, these are not, what he's not suggesting a synthesis in which, you know, faith and reason are reduced to one another. Rather, it's an actual hybrid, where these two very different things are both present. That's Statius, and he articulates the human whole, and what he articulates is, you know, more of a question. He leaves it as a question as to how these different aspects exist with one another.
Well, Paul, we only got to one of the five discussions that we were planning on talking about. But as usual, I think I can talk to you for hours, but unfortunately, our time is out. So let me just say thank you so much. This was a great conversation, Paul, and thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thanks so much for asking me, Jeff. And you know, after you hang up, I'll call you and you can talk for 2 or 3 more hours.
Sounds great.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.